This is Detention, a podcast dedicated to candid conversations about education. I'm your host, Dr. Nadia Lopez, a global leader, author, speaker, coach, consultant, and entrepreneur who opened a school to close a prison. Join me as I share my insights and bring fellow disruptors to serve time in conversation. Rebels, let's get into some good trouble. Hello, Detentionites. I hope that your heart and spirit is well today. In this episode, I am in conversation with Dr. Travis Brown. He is my friend and colleague and is the CEO and proud principal of Farris Academy in the Boogie Down Bronx. He is also the co-founder of Teach Jam that has been dubbed the homecoming of professional development that centers the needs of urban educators. And what they do is provide live interviews, panel discussions, and activations from top educators. I actually had the honor and privilege of serving as their keynote speaker at the inaugural event that occurred in the Bronx in November of 2022. And it was quite the experience. It's definitely something that you have to see in person for yourself, because it's just truly magical to be amongst so many educators dedicated to Black and Brown children. Now, Travis has decades of experience in the world of education. He has served as a teacher and a leader in traditional public schools, which are district schools. And then he transitioned into becoming the leader of two charter schools. So he knows what it takes to open up a school, the setbacks and politics that comes with this work, and how it can all compromise your health when you give more than you have. Travis's journey was important to tell because he has the charter and district school experience and can speak to what works and what doesn't in both sectors. But it's also important to amplify his voice because in New York City, there are only 4% Black male educators. Despite those statistics, Travis has been able to evolve and transition into positions within education that allows him to remain creative and have impact at his school and beyond. This was actually intended to be one episode, but we ended up covering so much, and in order to do this conversation any justice, it had to become two parts. So here's the first one. Now let's get into it. This episode is being brought to you by Elevated BLK, which focuses on personal development and sustainability for educators. We offer live and on-demand courses that help you to build your skills, see your vision, or pivot from the position. You can check out our apparel line, join our newsletters, or even see the books that we offer by visiting www.elevatedblk.com. Travis, I always call you Travi, my main man, Travi. I'm so glad to introduce you to the Detentionites. And if there was going to be somebody I was going to have a conversation about education from the Black male perspective in New York City, as well as just talking about charter school, it was going to be you. So I literally held off my conversations about charter schools until this very moment, because it could be a very nuanced dialogue, but we both have done public as well as been in the realm of charter, so I will get into that. But I want to just jump right in to your pathway of becoming an educator, and especially in a system that 75% of the scholars are Black and Brown. Right. However, there is a lack of representation when it comes to Black educators, specifically Black and Latino educators, but specifically Black males. Right. Black and Brown males, you all make up only 7%. And oftentimes it's because, you know, there's no real role models or the pay. So I'm curious to, you know, to learn more by sharing with the audience, you know, what got you into education?
Yeah. Well, first, thank you for having me. Of course. Really an honor to, you know, share share a conversation with you and welcome me to your platform. So I really appreciate that. To answer your question, what got me into education? It wasn't by design. I was what they call a career changer. So out of college, I graduated from Temple University and started working for a consulting firm. And I think it started there. You know, college could be a very, you can still shelter yourself in college, but in corporate America, you know, sheltering yourself meaning being around just people who look like you. That kind of zebra effect, right? I'm gonna stay with the people the same stripes as me. But in corporate America, you know, I really hit like a culture clash, really, where I was the only black male in the entire office, and I didn't really see anyone who looked like me. And the company had affinity groups, so I joined like this black affinity group, and that's where I kind of got that this little group where you're with other black people, but on a day to day, I didn't really see people who look like me, and it wasn't. You know, it wasn't like it was problematic, like I couldn't do my job or anything. I just wondered why. Like, why were there not more people of color? And it wasn't about like black men of color. There was just no black people. And computer science, this is 2001. And I was a computer science major, went in there doing a little coding and other things with technology. And I struggled, it struggled in my head, why don't we have representation? Why are we just not here? And I just felt like if I felt this way, other people felt that way, would feel this way coming up, and I have to do something about it. So through the affinity group, I was working in Philadelphia Public Schools because we had to do volunteer work. And honestly, I just fell in love with teaching chess to students, doing mathematics with students, and it kind of connected this wondering I had around why are there not more of us in spaces like corporate America, and also the love I found with working with young people. So I kind of connected those two and joined the New York City Teaching Fellows to teach mathematics. And that was kind of my journey into teaching. And I just it got me back to New York also. So excuse me, because I was in Philadelphia at the time. So it did a lot for me. It helped me follow this newfound passion that I had for kids. It helped me chase my wonderings around why are there not more of us here? And then also it got me back to my mom and my family. So it was kind of like the trifecta for me that it got me into teaching.
That's good. You know, it's one, I did an interview with Giovanni, who is a fellow new leader and cohort member, and it's, I feel like a majority of us who were in the fellow it, new leaders had some type of connection to the New York City Teaching Fellows, because I was a career changer as well. So now you are in the school system, and this is the early 2000s. And so, what different positions or different schools were you at?
I was at Harry S. Truman High School. That's where I started teaching in the northeast section of the Bronx, Co-op City. I taught mathematics there, and in a short time, I became a dean of students also. So very large, about 3,500 kids. So I joined the staff as the dean, really working with discipline. And those were my two primary roles: mathematics teacher, high school math teacher, and also dean and discipline at Truman. And I did that for a little I would say 5 years. And then, you know, and then that's when I joined you with New Leaders for New Schools. So I think I was in a classroom for 5 years, also taught the YABC program, you know, night school as well. So I did a lot of my time, but then shifted, went through New Leaders for New Schools where they were tapping talent to lead schools. So I started that and then founded a school after that.
Okay, so just for people to get a little bit of background context, New Leaders, at the time they had the whole name, New Leaders for New Schools. Now they shorten it down to New Leaders. But it is an aspiring, a program that basically prepares aspiring principals to either found their own schools, it could be public or charter, or take over schools or serve in some capacity of leadership. So you didn't necessarily have to go into the principalship. You could be an assistant principal or some
Right.
type of position that would have impact on children. What drew me to the program was the fact that one, it was national, so we got to travel. I love that part. But two, it actually, brought us together. And it was so many Black and brown people. We were what it should look like in the school system that has a predominance of children of color. So I feel like they had more than 75%. It might have been like 80% of us as their talent, part of this program. And we went for Chicago, the Bay Area, Maryland. So it was Prince George's County and Baltimore, Newark, Tennessee, as well as New York. And I think they later added on North Carolina. And so what was great is that we got to and New Orleans. So we got to travel just about almost every 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks to these different cities, convene as a cohort. And at the time, it was 131 of us, but our New York City chapter had the largest group.
It did.
And so we gave our coaches the business. We were not going to allow them to tell us what they thought we should be doing. We gave them a run for their money, but I think that what was great about it is that we were such a tight cohort
Right.
and we had each other's back. And it was when I really realized, I was pushed into wanting to be a leader, but being surrounded by so many like-minded people was something that I felt like, okay, I could really do this work. And you and I were like the brother and sister of the group, bickering 1 minute, cool the next minute. Like but it was the best year ever. So now you went through the pathway. We both wrote proposals to open up schools. You open up your school. Share a little bit about that process, what your school's theme was, and what ultimately happened.
I submitted a proposal to open a new school. They, long story short, they said we love the proposal, but what you would have to do is join a network. It was a lot of networks at the time. They said we have a space in Harlem, but you would have to become an urban assembly school. So, I didn't know what that entailed at the time, honestly. There's a lot we didn't know about the system. We just knew from the leaders we had to go in and we had to make change. So I said, okay, let's do it. Let's play ball. So I went into West Harlem, 129th Amsterdam, and I founded the Urban Assembly Institute for New Technologies. So this was a time where the Department of Education was giving a lot of money to try to really disrupt using technology. And really, this is the infancy of the empowerment zones, where we just empowered principals. They said, we don't know what's going to push us in the future. We're going to give you a boatload of money and you figure it out on the ground. So I was a recipient of a lot of money and a lot of support from Google at the time and a lot of other industry leaders at the time to really start thinking about what schools can be in the future. My school was called New Technologies. So I guess we were supposed to do new technologies. And my background is computer science. So I said, hey, it fit, but in true fashion in our public education system, when my school was founded, I was in District 5, a choice district. So all the kids chose where they wanted to go to school. So my school was filled with students who weren't placed or a lot of overage undercredited students, because that's how those things work out sometimes. So I think about over 50% of my population were overage for middle school aged and really failed or struggled in other schools. So what started out as we're going to do this cool computer science program, push new technologies and new methodologies at middle school and really change the game, turned into which I'm proud of, a community school where young people face failure early on, and how do you support them through that and make them successful? So that's what it was supposed to be, but what we got is what we find common in our system. A lot of students that, for whatever reason, were have been underserved and not supported the way they should be for success. So that's what I inherited, a small school that just had a lot of young people that were broken early on by a system. No, I'm not blaming, principals or the schools they went to. It's just what it was at the time. And as you know, you step in and you figure it out for those babies.
Well, I don't even know how to it's the tension, so I'm gonna keep a 100 on this platform. Here's the thing. We go in really believing that we understand what the needs are of the kids, right? The community. We are representation of those places that are considered high risk, impoverished. And so when we went through this program, it just felt like I have this opportunity of opening up a school where children are really going to get what they deserve and providing them with this tremendous opportunity that will change their lives.
Right.
And that writing the proposal process is not easy. Getting your, essentially what seems like a board, but your proposal team together to put all these pieces in place, it's constant revisions, it's late nights, it's pouring your heart into this idea. Then it's the part about presenting this to the Department of Education. You literally sit before a committee who is asking you, like firing up these questions to see if you're fit for the position, if you're fit to be the lead, if you understand what the mission and vision of what new schools are supposed to be. And then you get the school and you're like, yes. And then when you're actually in the community, in the seat, there are all of these just the red tape, the bureaucracy, and all of the boundaries that are set in place to almost sabotage the entire process, right? Like you and I opened up schools and we went through what it meant to be, founding school leaders. And in no way, shape, or form were we ever trying to exclude any of the children, but the schools were based off of themes.
Right.
So you wanted those who had an interest, right?
Correct.
They didn't understand what it was. They were tied to the mission and vision. And then when you open up a school, it's just like what they give you are children who literally have been failing within the system without giving you the proper support. And if you're not strong and grounded in the instructional practice, in social emotional learning, you could fail. Like it literally is almost a setup for failure if you're not grounded in this work, right? And so what ends up happening is exactly what you have to do. You have to put aside what your mission and vision is for the school, right? What you thought was going to be this utopian society based off of your proposal. And now focus on what do I have in front of me? How do I target the specific needs in this building? And then at some point, I'm going to mirror or marry in what my intention was. Because I have to get them to one, see themselves and develop their own self-efficacy. And then I have to now be able to connect the dots for them to know, like, you deserve more. And so what I'm providing for you are those very things. So we do the miracle workers work, and you had this school, but how long were you at that school?
For 3 years.
Okay. And then after those 3 years, what happens?
Yeah, that's when I joined the charter world. So I got this opportunity to head up a school for underage, overage, undercredited, caught in systems involved youth in Brooklyn called Rhodes Charter School. So that kind of pulled at my heartstring. And some people pulled me into it, and that's when I joined. I left the Department of Education and went to the charter world to really take on this tough type of population that nobody wanted to take on. They wanted to open it a year earlier, but they could not find a leader to take on the challenge of supporting 250 court and systems involved youth. So I said, you know that speech they give you, that they give you when they're hyping you up. You know, they need someone, and if not you, then who? You
Right.
know,
Yeah.
not you,
Like you
then
go to
who?
the army.
Yeah, if
You'll
not you,
fight
then
more.
who? And you know, and you like, yeah, if not me, then who? And you find yourself in another situation. That's what education does to you for a while. It's a beautiful thing, but it can also not allow you to think and say, ask the right questions, like, are the systems in place, like you were talking about? Are the supports in place? We're going to work with population of students that have a history of failure and a systemic, and just a new face, no matter how good you are and how brilliant you think you are, or you are, and the great ideas. There's a lot of old problems and deep-rooted problems. And as we learn, there's adaptive challenges and technical challenges, and you have to make sure that all the planets are aligned. Or in this case, there's real systems alignment to help these young people with their support. But I didn't think about any of that, because they said, if not you, then who? So then I'm like, it's me. So you race there and you go and you start. And then, like you said so eloquently, you get there, and then it's like, boom, the systems are not in place. You see, you're just there with a white paper. You know, somebody wrote all this wonderful stuff, this proposal that actually a lot of it can't happen or doesn't make sense on the ground. You know, when you get there, and I think one of the biggest, the toughest parts that I think we did wrong, in founding Rhodes, was we marketed it too well as the silver bullet for the magic bullet for all problems for kids who were in ACS and court, and then ACS loved us. Like, yeah, we got a school for these kids. So, you know, we opened one in Brooklyn, we opened one in the Bronx. I was the principal of the one in Brooklyn. And I mean, we just had all the problems. And I mean that in a lot of kid problems, you know, the kids going through a lot of real stuff. And were we equipped to handle it from the design of the charter? No. From our systems? No. And honestly, it was too overwhelming in a lot of cases, because, you know, like, even in a hospital, everybody can't be in the emergency room.
Right.
Some people have to just be getting, you know, just getting a little checkup here and there. And our system was just flooded with the most severe cases. And we're talking about young people that are 17 years old, reading on a second grade reading level, kids who were, you know, young people who had children. It was just everything you can think of. It was just a cocktail of all the kids' challenges and the failings of our community and other schools or whatever, things like that, just balled up into one place. And of course, as we do as educators, we don't complain. We bite down, we find a team, and we fight through it. But we, as I've learned in my advanced age now, people matter a lot, but the magic happens when you have good and great people, but the infrastructure is there. You gotta have infrastructure to make these things sustainable, scalable, and work for a majority of kids. Because as educators, we all have stories about the one or two kids, right? Or the five kids or the 10 kids that we did miraculous work for. But we don't talk about the stories about the hundreds of kids, the thousands of kids that you weren't able to touch because it was just you and someone else. But, and that's where we need the infrastructure. And Rhodes, in this case, we didn't really think deeply about the infrastructure that's going to get all the babies through. And when I mean infrastructure, the supports, the systems, the wraparound service, the outpatient care, the extra, we didn't think about those things in a really deep way and sustainable way. So there was a lot of success stories, and I could sit here and talk to you about a lot of success stories, but also there's a lot of failure. And I think that's of something that a lot of school leaders are afraid to talk about and afraid to share, because we want to seem like we're superheroes. And one of the things I learned through new leaders, I learned from my early on, and running a DOE school and also running a charter school early on is that we need to stop promoting this idea that one person can make it happen. If you find a super principal, like we can make it happen. No, you need an amazing team. And that's what these programs really didn't push. I felt enough around. Do you have a team that complements each other to really do this work and make it sustainable? Because you have principals killing themselves and taking on too many things. And the reason being is because we don't incentivize a five-person instructional a leadership team, no matter how small a school is. That's the thing. Like, you have to invest in the infrastructure. It doesn't matter if a business has 100 employees or 1,000 employees. Certain things need to be the same inside the school. Certain infrastructure. You need HR, right? You need operations. You need certain things. So in my case, I had these real small schools. In a lot of cases, it was just me. And you kill yourself that way. And you don't build sustainable things. You don't build infrastructure. So I've learned that. And this has took me a couple rodeos around. It's like, I don't need to be great. And asking people to be great every day is problematic. That leads to you asking somebody to burn out, to be great every day, to be, and we know greatness comes from consistency and it comes from systems, but we're not building schools like that. We've adopted this, and this is what I want to share also to Black and Brown educators. Got to be very clear. Don't think that you're going to be the new, improved, super amazing educator, principal that's going to make a leader that's going to make it all happen that keeps you there at 12 o'clock at night. You have to build systems. You have to build infrastructure. You have to build team. That's the key to success. It's not about you. Like, nobody's going to be a better principal, more dedicated principal than Nadia Lopez. It can't happen. When I see principals, I look at you like, you ain't Nadia on the love for the babies and things like that. But guess what? We shouldn't be fighting all the time to say we're better. We should be fighting to build team and build systems that going to get a lot of our to get all of our kids through the system at a really high level. And I think that's the thing, because we get burned out. Roads took me down, you know, like took me down because I'm at shelters, kids getting shot, so I'm at the precinct. Like, it's a lot. And you know better than anybody else, you stop taking care of yourself. And you can't take care of yourself because you're always on call. You're always answering the bell. And that's what was happening, always answering the bell instead of building infrastructure. So you're muscling through things and you're pushing through and you're not eating and you're up and you're trying to support everyone, but you're not building effective systems. You're not building the necessary teams. And that's what I've learned early on. So I would urge anybody, like when you're building a school and you're in a school, I need to see the infrastructure because you don't need accidental success. You need something that's sustainable and you need something that lives beyond you. I was the founding principal of two schools. They no longer exist because it was me. And it tried to move on without me, but I was there. I started everything and I stopped everything. And things weren't written down and we didn't build the necessary systems in place, and we didn't write it down, and we didn't codify those things, and we didn't push against them every year to make them better. And those are the things that you learn. But far too often, school leaders are running in thinking, you know, I'm the one. And I would tell you, you're never going to be the one. It's going to be your team and your system. You're only as good as your infrastructure you build and the team that you build and those accountability structures. So I'll be quiet there, but that was my kind of rodeo.
No, let me tell you something. I literally had to just stop, turn around, get some paper and pen to start writing notes because you said so much that I want to bring back, right? Just from where you started from, when you talked about we don't talk about the failures, even when it comes to the young people that we can't touch all the lives and you know. That's part of ego, right? The realness of the position is that we see a lot of failure within the system because it's driven by ego. And a lot of times it's all about the position and the power that comes with it, right? So you and I personally didn't go into this on like we're driving this because we want to be the most powerful. We went into it because we really believe like we were part of the Wolverines and the storms of the world that can come in and really change what education could look like in places that we, you know, people were saying it's not possible, but we're a product of that. So we knew it was possible, right? But the reality of it is that the system, which is comprised of people, will make you feel like you're a failure if you're not doing the tens of thousands of different jobs, if you're not working until 12 o'clock at night, if you're not at the hospital, because at some point, if you're not doing all of those things, it's almost connected to your identity that makes you appear like you're not doing your best. So therefore, you're the failure. And so there's never any room for us to separate ourselves from from what's happening without our control. Like we don't have control about the choices that children are making or the circumstances that they're in, right? And no one ever prepares us for that. Like new leaders never prepared us for any parts of that. They prepared us for observations through John Safir. They prepared us for using a rubric through Kim Marshall and having hard conversations, difficult conversations with Paul Heifetz, right? But they didn't say, here's the politics of the system. They didn't say, how do you sustain yourself? How do you create boundaries so that you're not killing yourself? How do you really look at a strong team beyond you? It was about teachers and the principal, right? There was never any, how do you effectively build a team of other leaders so it's not all on you? And so there was a lot of that missed mark. And we had to learn by the burnout, right? That's real. And what's interesting is no one wants to ever talk about that burnout. Like it's kind of like, now I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about how I didn't get support. No, like we literally will in exist not naming the things that also cause trauma and harm to us. Yeah, right. And so here's what I will say. Because of your school, I had scholars who did benefit because I had some of those overage, undercredited young people who came into Mott Hall, Bridges Academy. They clearly needed to be in another institution that was going to allow them to start taking those high school credits, giving them the chance to graduate on quote unquote time so that they weren't further behind. So I had between Mr. McLeod, who was my guidance counselor, he would literally put he had a relationship with one of your counselors. And so we would literally have our scholars go through. And our scholars did well simply because they still had a school to come back to. So while they were going to your school, they didn't need the wraparound services because they was coming to our school to get everything that they were like, oh no. We still want our what we're deserving of here at Mott Hall. So we had them. But you talked about the failure of the system, but it's hard for the system, right? And people in it to teach us how to create anything sustainable when they don't know what it looks like. Like there was never a model, right? And so, and there still isn't a model. It really becomes one off, like one school or a series of school that may be under a franchise of sorts that has the thing that allows the leaders to be successful, allows the children to actually show that they are gaining, they're closing the achievement gaps and they're doing well social emotionally. But I do want you to talk about this change from public to charter. And I want to get into that conversation because, you know, when I spoke to you, I said, you know, there's this recent episode of Abbott Elementary, and most educators are in love with it, and it's a great depiction. And what's so interesting is that you started out volunteering in Philadelphia Public Schools. That's where the setting of Abbott Elementary takes place. And Quinta Brunson's mom was a public school teacher. The recent episode, and it's been two episodes, right? They kind of did an introduction to the charter schools coming into communities and taking over. And the first setup was like the aesthetics of the building and what allures people to wanting to go into a charter school because public schools are failing just based off of
The look.
the building is structured, right? And the textbooks that they have at their disposal. And then the second episode that they bring up it was around the fact that the charter school, if you will, like the CEO, he wanted to now turn Abbott Elementary, which was his former school as a child, into a charter school. And was going after the parents to, going to the board to present why Abbott Elementary should turn into a charter. And so I was like, oh, I need to have this conversation. If there's one person I would love to discuss that with, because you're currently sitting as a charter school principal, you've been through public school as a founding leader, simply because there was a time where I was so anti-charter, right? And
Me
I was
too.
anti, right? We were both anti-charter, and it was really because of the way that they were coming in and having a lack of regard for those who were already there. So it felt like the gentrification of public education, one. Two, there was no real conversation about what it meant. Or let's look at if these schools are failing that exist, what is actually the plan to support and improve these schools? It was just a matter of first, we started with the voucher program. They were giving the parents vouchers, move them out. They can go to a school of their choice that happened to be charter-esque. Then it was this whole movement of we're just going to put charters in, especially in New York. They were moving into the public school buildings. So literally, you were like, oh, so they're just going to take over a floor. And the way they would, I want to say, trick out the floor was just like, I want to go to the charter school too. Like, they're putting in hundreds of thousands of dollars to remodel floors, but they would never do it for the school that already existed. Like if we were principals at that time and we said, hey, I want to get new flooring. I want to get a state-of-the-art room. It was a whole, you need capital funding, you need to apply, to the city council. It's going to take you 2 years before we can even say it's approved. Then it's going to take another year and a half, right? Charter schools come in, it's done in like 3 months, right? Before they even open up their doors. And so essentially what happened was charters seem to have been the savior model. They're coming in. They even had this Waiting for Superman documentary that made it seem like, oh my God, if your kids are not in a charter, they're not going to be successful. Right. And so for a lot of families, it was like, if my kid doesn't get in, then they are just never going to be anything because they have to go to the public school. And so the kids internalize it as, well, I'm not going to be successful because I'm going to this regular public school. And so a lot of it caused teachers and principals to feel demoralized because it took away from we're trying our very best given the little that we have. Right. So getting back specifically to you being the founding principal 3 years into your school, what made you? Because I know they said you're the one. But there was a part of you at some point that was like, nah, I'm not rocking with y'all. What really made the shift for you to go to charter? And even though that you had the failures of Rhodes, you're still to this day a charter school principal and see. Yeah.
It's a lot. Boy, I think the first thing is charters are very public. They're public schools and they operate off of public funding. Charters do have the ability to take private dollars. That's what that's a big differentiator, if you will, from a district school as we know it, and a charter school that could be on the same floor. So a lot of that remodeling and fixing up and all those things and the new TVs and new equipment could be coming from private dollars as well. But in my case, and that's my school's case, we don't have any private funding. We do our money off of all of the public funding. So I like to consider myself in a lot of ways the uncharted charter. That's what we say, and that's what we keep because of our values around kids and our commitment to kids, teachers, and alike. I must admit, and I think a lot of people will admit that the charter space is growing older. Very early on, there was frankly mistreatment of children and disrespect of cultures, and as you said, the people who were here before. We can't ignore that or have a revisionist history to say that we haven't without naming any charter organizations. I remember when we went to New Orleans, and I'm not saying any names, and we were in a charter school, and the little boy said, "I can't speak to anybody in the school." I don't know if you remember that. And we were like, "Why?" And he's like, "Because I got in trouble." So he had this fake gold chain on with some, I forgot what the word said on his gold, this gold chain. And he couldn't speak to any children. He only could speak to adults. So when anything is placed in the wrong hands, or not even the wrong hands, when people are misunderstood or miseducated around things, or bring in their own schema of what things should be and mental models should be without talking to the people who are there, who are live and well, and not even considering the parents and the elders in the community, you're going to always have misalignment, tension, and things like that. And I think early on, charters were anti-parents in a lot of ways to say, "You're doing everything wrong. That's why your children are failing. We're going to do everything right in this space." Without mentioning names, I was in a meeting with one charter school leader here in New York, and he said his job is to keep the kids away from their parents. I had to get up and walk out the meeting. Early on, there were stories around how Kip used to go in your home and take the TV out of your bedroom. You don't need that, So there's a lot of stories around just how charter schools in the charter space encroached on a lot of people, culture, everything, because they had to be anti that to educate kids. And I think that was wrong when we hear the stories. We know the popular ones, we know the stories, we know those things. I just ask everybody in the education space to judge charters not as a whole, as an umbrella, but to start looking and say there are charter schools that have black and brown leaders from top down. Like my board chair is a man from this community, Bronx community. He's of Hispanic origin, and he's the board chair of a charter school, right? And he takes pride in the school, and my board members are very diverse, many of which are from the community and are black and brown. And we talk about that at the board level. Do we have the right representation of women? Do we have the right representation of the races that reflect the kids we serve? Do we have the right number of parents on the board? Do we have students? So there are places that are pushing. So I ask the community to not judge charters as a whole or umbrella, but look at individual ones. And I think we also have that there's the big box brands, if you will, that are, that people look at and say those are the corporate ones or the ones that just multiply, But then there's independent charters. Like we're an independent charter and we don't have aspirations to gain real estate. We don't want to be 10, 15, 20 schools, and do that. So I think charters are just different, like public schools are different in a lot of ways. And I had to learn that because I was in District 5, and District 5 in Harlem was the hotbed for charters at one time. And when I had my district DOE school, they were, we hate them over there. But you want to look, we got to look under that because, and then you also have to look at the authorizers and say there are bodies, the DOE is an authorizer, SUNY is an authorizer, that also push charters to do better for the community. So when they said we don't support students with IEPs or ESL students, we have to match the district that we're in. We have to match those percentages. We get dinged for that. People don't know that. So when they come in and they look at the school and they authorize the school at the end of the charter term, they're going to look at our numbers and say, your community has 30% special education. Are you in that number? If you're not, we can't give you the highest number of years renewal. You have the community has ESL percentage of 24%. The community that you live in, that your school resides in, do you have that? So we have to be reflective of our community. When you look at our preferences, because charters do lotteries by law, we have a special education preference and we have a ENL's preference. So I think we have to look deep about the schools we talk about, because some may still be on your list like, oh hell no, but some may be on your list like maybe this is feels like what we want education to be. I think that's important how we look at it. And I think we need both. I don't think we should replace the public school system. And this is as a charter leader, I don't think we should replace the public school system at all. I think let's make our schools better. We have to stop fighting. And this is just my belief, and this is not the belief of the organization that I lead or anything like that. Like, we have to stop trying to kick down the doors of specialized schools, and we have to create more specialized schools. We have to create more specialized schools, and we have to create more great schools, whether they're charters or districts or privates or anything like that. Kids need access to great education, and parents need choice to great education. And I mean, great education means so many things, because it's about what you're measuring. So I think you got to measure test scores, but you also have to measure culture also in schools. And do young people come out feeling nurtured? Do they come out feeling having a stronger sense of self? And do they come out with still aspiration and not beat down from the system? So we have to have a lot of metrics other than test scores that assess some of these schools, because I think that's where the proliferation of charters have started also, because charters learn I get more by having high test scores, but at what cost? But we keep driving just one number or two numbers, math and ELA, then if that becomes our master, we're just gonna push for that. And if you're not looking at anything else, then when I come out on top with that, you're telling me I get more? What game are we playing and what are we incentivizing? So the system starts to look like what we care about only. So it's like we have to have a lot of other measures, and we got to really care about other measures of school. And school performance, student performance is a big key performance metric, right? Young people have to know how to read, of course. Young people need to know how to do mathematics. Numeracy is key. So these things, and we have to do science well and social studies well and everything well. But how we look at schools, charters have pushed. And I'm just talking about in our recent history to get these scores. And sometimes it performance management managed kids out in the process. Some of these graduation rates that some of these charters boast was because they started with 100 kids in ninth grade. And by 12th grade, there was 16 kids there. Because you had kids walking through the 15 years old. Well, I remember I visited charter school and during transition to the high school, the kids had to read books while they were transitioning in the hallway and not talk. You ever walked in a hallway, walked and had to read a book? So there's some wrong things that were done to black and brown kids around socializing them and compliance and things like that. And that was wrong in the charter space. A lot of organizations that used to do it have evolved also, because people change over and new ideas. So I think just like everything, there needs to be fresh eyes that look over the charter space to see some of the advancements and some of the changes that have been made from because of people like yourself and people that just say we need to get back. It's not how you treat children. So even when I came here, they used to do some things where the kids walked through the hallway. They had to do some weird thing where it was like fishtails. So the kids had to put their hands behind their back and act like they had a fish. I'm like, you want me to make adults walk through the hallway like that? Not doing that. There was history here where kids were getting left back in kindergarten. So that's one of the first policies I put in place. I said, when we start out a video game, we can't die in the first board. first board of that video game is to get you to the second board, but our kids were being killed, like being held back. And we're still seeing, I've been here for 8 years, I'm still looking at young people that are now in 12th grade that are 20 years old. And when I look back, I said, oh, because before I got here, they left you back in kindergarten or first grade. So there's history of wrongdoing in a lot of our charter schools. And we have to talk about that to make sure it doesn't happen again. So I don't think we can wipe it away. And a lot of people are hurt by it. And a lot of people outside the charter community are still looking to us like those practices are still happening. And again, I don't look at all charter schools, so I don't know. But I think it's important that we still examine and make sure that they are treating our young people right, and that the representation of these boards match the schools, and a representation of leadership, and we are having these connected conversations, these courageous conversations around. But this should happen in all schools, as we've seen in the private schools. I think a year or two ago, when all these the kids started coming out and saying, "Hey, y'all did this to me when I was there, and I feel this way," you know. And I think in the charter school space, they came out against democracy prep around these things and some of the ills that happen as young people get older, go to college, graduate, and they say, "Wait, this didn't feel right now," you know. So I think the charter space has some skeletons in the closet around how they treat black and brown kids and black and brown parents also, and excluded them that we have to fix. And those are some of the things. That's why I'm appreciative of my Department of Education experience. I tell everybody, this school is what it is today because of the Department of Education. Because the way the Department of Education and the union requires you to treat its teachers, I'm able to bring that over here. So I follow a lot of policy that I learned in the Department of Education, because there's a lot of great things in the Department of Education that also we don't speak about. Because you can find wrong in anything, but I try to distill out the good and see what the spirit is of what in the story underneath. So there's a lot of great things that I think makes this school quality because of the Department of Education. But overall, I think I would love for everybody to look at charters and say, let's look in, and let's look in deeply. Do they support young people the right way? Do they treat them the right way when young people mess up and disappoint? Do they treat them the right way? And I think that's important.
Well, you said a couple of things that stood out. So one, let's just be honest. There are schools that are doing harm to children in the traditional district schools as well as in charter, right? And it comes down to leadership, it comes down to accountability. So that's the first thing, because there are public schools that you would never send your kids just simply because of how violent it is, the lack of any type of programming. Teachers are not qualified to be in those schools, and they exist, right? They get to exist. But one of the important key factors that you brought up that is always the link to this all is the parents, right? Sometimes it's about having a conversation with the parent who puts their child in charter and speaking to the parent who keeps their child in the district schools, right? Parents should have a choice. My issue with some of the charters was how they presented themselves. They made it seem like educators in public schools didn't want better for the kids, right? Like, you know, these schools are failing kids. They're not giving them updated stuff, and like, I don't have control over the time. That's the union who negotiated that. So, of course, they would say, oh, your children are going to a school where it's unionized and we don't have unions. But then you have some charter schools where the teachers are working an excessive amount of hours and are, because of that, they have like a 9 to 10 hour day, right? They have extended hours that they have to be on call for parents. And so you have a lot of people who are burning out, and there's a lot of turnover when it comes to teachers, right? But it could be in either setting, because if you're not getting supported and the job is overwhelming, then people do have a right to say, I don't want to be part of this anymore because I can't sacrifice myself for children, but no one's taking time to make sure I'm well, right? But then there's the other part where
specifically when they move into schools and they other the folks who were originally there, right? And we see it in gentrification. Like it just becomes, they don't talk to you. They act like they're the elite. They act like, you know, we're better than you. We had to come in here because y'all are failing kids, as opposed to bridging the gap and saying, we have to coexist in this space. Let's work on building a relationship. What do we have that we can be a support to you? What can we learn from you because you've been here, right? There's a way of mediating this conversation and not make it always feel like we're stealing from you. I co-located and I was a public school, right? I was a district school. One of the things I never did, I never approached the kids downstairs and said, come to my school. I wasn't going to do that. People thought we were a charter school, but I refused because I felt like we have to build relationships, because at the end of the day, all of these kids are going to the same community. They're going to the same project. They're cousins, and they're going to be at the same family reunion. So it's not right for me to sit here and try to act like my school is better in any sense.
But don't you think the system, the center, the cent, ah, the system incentivizes that,
Right.
the competition?
It incentivizes the competition, but something that you and I spoke about when I visited your school, and you didn't make mention. So you have to make mention of your school, the name of your school.
Oh, Farris Academy, the Farris Academy Charter School in the Bronx.
Yeah, you didn't make mention. You jumped into it. So I don't want people confusing it with Rhodes. You have since transitioned into a new charter school that you're leading, and you are, the branding is off the hook. It's like, you know, he has put in 1,000% into, it's a brand all the way through and through. But just thinking about funding, and that's a big conversation that people just don't understand if they're not in the charter school world. New York City school principals, most principals in the United States, if you're on a district level, you don't know the actual funding scheduling, right? Like you don't know. I learned it because Dr. John King, the one who taught us as well when we were at in Boston, about he was the principal at the time of Roxbury Prep before he became Secretary of Education and now Commissioner of New York. But he literally, it was myself, Dr. Stephen Perry, and Dr. Perry was saying to me, like, you know, there's a lot you can do with the $10,000 you get per child or $11,000 you get per child. And I was like, I don't get that amount of money. He was like, what do you mean? That's what everybody gets. And I was like, I do not get that. And he was like, it's not possible. You're in New York State. And I said, I get $4,500 per child. And then John King steps in because he was, you know, New York State Commissioner. He was like, she gets 4,500, you get the full amount, right? And so from right now on a general education level for children who are general ed, how much do you get per child?
Whatever the formula is, so it's about 17,000, something like that.
17,000 per child, and does that include special education?
But you get an additional amount of money for special education depending on their classification.
So if a child is self-contained, meaning they're in a class with 12 other young people and have a paraprofessional perhaps for the class or attached to them, you get additional money. If the child is what we call an inter ICT or CTT, collaborative co-teaching model, there is a certain amount of money. Or if they get what we call resource room, they're pulled out for a couple of hours, or the resource room teacher comes in and just provides them support in certain classes, right? Either way,
You get the same money New York City Public School as a district gets.
so let's be clear when you say that. New York City public schools. So what Travis gets for a general ed child, 17,000, let's say for general ed. And then let's just say it's 25 or 26,000 for a child with special needs, right? That needs additional services. That amount of money he gets to operate his school, to pay for his teachers, to provide the programming, that's part of the budget per child. So if he has 200 kids, 400 kids, you multiply that by that amount. What happens when you're in a New York City public school is the district is the Department of Education. They get the money first, and then they create this timetable or this funding table of what each school will get. So I don't get $17,000. I get $4,500 as a principal, baseline. If the child is considered quote unquote poor, I'm going to get additional $500. If the child is below a proficiency, so if they're a level one or level two, I'm going to get an additional $1,500. Right. And if the child has their second language learners, I'm going to get an additional $3,500. The money is still less than the $17,000 or $26,000.
But if, I would argue, right. So there's, that's what, this is where the conversation is. There's pros and cons, because there's a lot of things. That's what I say, the difference between my situation and a building principal in New York City Department of Education, there's a lot of things that I have to think about and pay for.
Yes.
Out of that 17.5, that what your traditional principal in a DOE school doesn't have to think about because it is. So just a classic example is, I have to worry about the phone bill or the Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. It doesn't come up, you know? So the amount of money it takes to have those things in place, or health insurance, you know, payroll taxes, those types of things, because that thing is kind of on a back end that never touches you, right? So I would have to do the math to see like what's my true money spent per child, like on, you know, that are not going to salaries, you know, payroll taxes, benefits, infrastructure, paying rent. So those are the things out of the budget that, you know, when I was a DOE principal, I had to think about paying teachers and programs, right? Here, I got to think about everything from, you know, if the heat goes off, like 2 years ago, the heat in one of the buildings went out.
Mm-hmm.
There was no heat. So that comes out of that budget. So there's a lot, like I have to have a contingency, like 3% of the budget, I can't even touch in case something happens to the building, right? I have to be able to have money in the bank to fix these things. So there's pros and cons on both sides. I think the conversation, and as you pointing out here, it's more complex.
Yeah.
People say, you know, I think charter school people have to understand the system and what a building principal gets.
Mm-hmm.
That can be different, right? And the inflexibility of that. And then on the other side, we have flexibility, but it's not unlimited. You know, like we still have additional bills that we have to pay, things we have to think about, having money in the bank. So there's, on both sides, there's pros and cons, different systems that I think we got to talk about and be clear about before we judge either side.
Well, I think that in your case, as well, is that you're not in a New York City public school building, right? And that was part of some of the backlash and why ultimately Bloomberg did have us create small schools, because he was pushing into public school buildings, the charters. So they didn't have to pay for rent. They didn't have to pay for heat, right? They were saving on that side of it. And these were going to a lot of those big franchise schools, whereas you, an independent charter school, you know, it's kind of like the mom and pop. You're still having to hustle to make it happen, right? And you're not getting the additional funding. So many of those other charters, they were saving on the leasing of a space. They were saving on the heating of a space. They were saving on school safety, because school safety was already automatically in the building. And then they were getting additional funding from investors and all these other people. So they always had an excess, which then puts them at an advantage. But like you said, the advantage, what do the children get? And so ultimately what I wanted people to know is like the charter school, district school. And I think it's important to say it that way, as opposed to charter versus public school, because they're both public school entities. It comes down to who's leading it and who's over it, right? A charter school is governed by a board, which is a body of individuals who come together to ensure that the school is being of sound mind and providing all that it's supposed to for the children fiscally, emotionally, academically, right? And holding the principal or the CEO accountable of that. Whereas a district school is governed by superintendent or chancellor as in New York City, but for the remainder of the United States, it's usually the superintendent of a specific district. And so the funds that are received from a state and federal government. Federal government doesn't give that much. It's usually the state and city that gives you the most money. But the fight really has to be on the most basic level. Are we doing right by kids? Are we giving the children what they deserve?
Hey, Detentionites. So here's where I'm going to pause and bring this part of our conversation to a close. Travis and I spoke so much, right? And we covered a lot of ground. And I hope that what you heard thus far offers clarity about charter and district schools when it comes to funding, the ways in which they operate, as well as what has worked and what doesn't in both models. Now, when it comes to Farris Academy, I want to stress that they are an independent charter schools. They are not connected to the larger networks that usually have about five or more schools in any given city or across the nation. You know, those networks tend to attract board members who are well connected that can fundraise millions of dollars annually that adds to a charter school's budget. Independent schools, they are like what I consider the mom and pops. They have one, maybe two schools, and they are part of a campus. Their funding, the large majority of it, they rely solely on state and federal funding. And while they may do fundraising, it doesn't necessarily boast $1 million annually. And it's not to say that they can't, but just don't use general terms when you're talking about charter schools. I want you to take time to get to know each individual school for what they do, because they're not all the same. I also want to acknowledge Travis's transparency and his willingness to be candid about the setbacks and challenges that he faced and the cost of it. You know, it is not easy to ever admit these type of things, but he makes a great point about how we are often celebrating our wins. We're quick to highlight the successes, but we never want to talk about those professional failures that we have all gone through, especially in leadership. But what didn't break us only makes us stronger. And good leaders own their roles, which comes with just the personal reflection to become intentional about improving and being better at leading. So stay tuned for part two when we get into what Travis is doing now with his conference, Teach Jam, and how he is on the rise to having national impact. I encourage you to check out the show notes to learn more about the conference so you can get your tickets to attend in June, which will be taking place in the Bronx at Farris Academy. And you will also get to get Travis's information about how to contact him on socials. All right, I look forward to sharing with you part two. Stay tuned. Thank you for serving time with me here in detention. Don't forget to subscribe and to tell a friend so that this way you're up to date on new episodes that will drop every week. You can also follow us on Instagram at Detention Podcast. If you want to learn more about my services as a coach, consultant, and keynote speaker, go to www.thelopezeffect.com. And let's stay connected on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram by following me on my handle, The Lopez Effect. Lastly, if you have any topic ideas, questions or comments, or want to sponsor future episodes, please send me an email at detentionwithdrnadialopez@gmail.com. All of this information will be in the show notes, so don't worry if you didn't get it down. I also want to send a gentle reminder to my disruptors and rebels. It's okay for us to get into a little bit of good trouble, but please take gentle care of yourself, be well, and never forget to choose you.